Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hey, everyone.
This week, we are doing our Season 3 finale for 2023, and we're closing out Season 3 with Maniac Cop 3.
Yeah.
We figured we did Maniac Cop 1 and 2 during this season. We might as well group the whole thing together. Close out our season with the movie that closed out the Maniac Cop trilogy. Now, this is certainly the weakest entry in the trilogy, but I think it's still a fun, worthwhile movie to check out.
Yeah, agreed. You know, you had said, when we did the first one, and I think again when we did the second one and you talked about all three of them, you had mentioned that 3 is not really as good, and there's also like a production story behind that holds, you know, for some of that reason. And, you know, I read some of that backstory, and I would say that in some ways, this movie is even more of a testament to the talent that Larry Cohen and William Lustig had, because despite both leaving the film, it's still decent. You know, it still comes out pretty good. I mean, a lot of it is stuff that they had done. But like they were both so disappointed with how things were going, probably not, you know, mostly about the film, because again, I think ultimately what was finally put together is actually still pretty good. It's certainly flawed, but still pretty good. And like that can't be easy. It's hard enough to do 3 good movies in a franchise. It's even harder to do that with horror, and doing it when, you know, the creative, you know, your director and writer leave the project in disgust and still coming up with something pretty good, like, that's a hell of a feat.
Yeah, I mean, this was William Lustig and Larry Cohen are both used to being very independent, you know, doing what they want, especially Larry Cohen. I mean, he usually did his movies, he's passed away, but, you know, from the ground up with pretty much creative control over everything.
Right.
And which is pretty much how they did the previous two Maniac Cops. I mean, Maniac Cop 1 was guerrilla filmmaking.
They didn't have permits, right?
Right. For 2, they did, you know, they had some backing and everything to make 2, and that's what they, I assume they'd hoped was going to happen with 3. With, you know, this new production company backing them up. But Hollywood is a business, movie making is a business, and the producers were treating this as a business. And, you know, when the budgets were getting over what they wanted to pay, they were like, and one of the producers, you can listen to this on the commentary for the Blue Underground DVD or Blu-ray. The producer even says, like, hey, as the producer, you know, William Lustig was the director, and his job is to make the best film he can possibly make.
Right.
As a producer, I'm supposed to make the film under budget. And,
right.
You know, that meant having to dip into the creativity. And, you know, Lustig didn't want to do that.
From what I read, like, I understand. I mean, I'm more on Lustig and Cohen's side than not, for obvious reasons, but at the same time, like, I guess I understand where the producers are coming from here, especially when you consider, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said this during the second one, like, the second one had a higher budget, right? The second one had a higher budget and more, like, weight thrown into it because of how well the first one did. But I believe a lot of, or some of that money, or not a significant portion of that money, came from its popularity in Japan. Is that right?
Well, the foreign market, especially this movie, is very popular in Japan. You know, the foreign markets help build the franchise. You know, when you see money is coming in from all these different directions, you can try to hope and count for that. Well, let's do another one, and we'll see that, you know, at least, you know, 2/3 of that as return. Because
right.
Sequels often have diminishing returns, and, you know, they prepare for that, all the bookkeeping and all that.
But is it fair to say, though, that the first movie, perhaps the second movie, doesn't get made with as much of a budget and care as it does, if not for money from the Japanese market?
Well, that
in other words, it was important to the film. It's fair to say it was important to the film.
It was definitely important to the film, but I don't say, you know, when the new producers came on to this one, it was obviously the Japanese market they were hoping to make a huge amount of money from.
Right.
And what you're leading to is how the original script for this movie was basically thrown out and had to be redone because the original concept from the film wasn't going to sell in Japan. And we'll get into that after we break down the film.
It ain't right. It's not what I would have done, but I also it's not your money when you're making the movie. And when you're the creator, you're trying to make your art, right? That's all you care about is the film itself and trying to make your vision the way you wanted to make it. But, you know, as you said, it doesn't necessarily work entirely that way when you're not playing with your own money.
Well, again, and it's an American expression you don't hear quite as much anymore, but if it don't play in Peoria, you don't get the money.
Right.
You know, you're trying to sell this movie to as wide an audience as possible. Right. So
Which, and again, sometimes like, I might call those like focus group movies, but sometimes those are pretty good. Like sometimes there's a reason they test well, but yeah, especially when it comes to something like this, and especially when you're going to see the third of the franchise that you've been following and you're a fan of Lustig and Cohen, like this becomes a disappointment. But, especially in light of it being the third of a horror franchise, it's still good. I still enjoyed it. We'll get into it, obviously. There are some pretty big flaws with the plot that end up as a result of what they had to do, but luckily that tends to be the weakest part of most horror movies anyway. So you can just ignore a lot of that.
Yeah. I would say, in some ways there is more action in this movie. Robert Davey returns as the, hero. He gets to be involved more in the action than he did in the previous one. And there's still some pretty spectacular stunts and effects going on.
Oh, sure. Yes, they at least, I don't, was it, you know, if that was filmed, if the ending was, I know a lot of the movie was done when they had to, when things started to have to change. Or at least that was my understanding, is that a lot of movie had already been done.
Lustig filmed as much as he could with what he had as a script. And then when all the changes, and the other things came down, I believe they only had an hour's worth of material.
Right.
So, and that's where you can see, one of the most unforgivable things for me in this movie is they use a sequence from Maniac Cop 2, not as flashback sequence. There's a lot of footage from Maniac Cop 1 and 2 used in this movie, but usually they relegate it to flashback.
It's a flashback, yeah.
So, you kind of expect that. But when you're inserting a sequence from a previous movie as if it's a part of the new story, it's not even a different angle.
Right.
It's pretty like, come on. You couldn't have filmed, and it's like a 15-second sequence probably, but like you couldn't film 15 seconds or something.
Right. Well, my 50-cent understanding of more or less what happened is that Cohen left first because he was like, nope, you're changing my movie, screw you. Lustig, I guess, tried to make it work with the new stuff, but didn't really have the time because it was just kind of thrown at them and didn't have time to like make it. He didn't have time to make it work to his content and actually make the movie that he wanted despite the restrictions. So he was just like, well, screw it, I'm out too.
Yeah, one of the producers had to finish out the film.
Okay. And I imagine that choice was probably a producer's choice. Just like, all right, let's just throw some footage of the old movie in here.
More than likely, yeah.
And it certainly feels like a choice you would make in that situation.
The movie is credited as an Alan Smithy film. Although it is understood that William Lustig, directed enough of the film to be considered the director. But he wanted his name taken off it because the finished product was not his vision and not his film.
Right.
I'm sure he doesn't enjoy the film, but regardless of it, I don't know if it's so much he took his name off in disgust, that it's probably part of it. But again, it's like, well, it's not my movie. What you're seeing isn't what I really did. I directed those sequences, but it's not my vision. It's not my movie. I don't want my name attached to it.
Yeah, you can see it both. I'm sure anger was part of it, but I do believe it was probably more to do with the fact, like, this was my baby, or at least his and Cohen's, right? And you've completely taken it from me, so screw you. Like, I'd be angry too.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't mine. The first two were, but this isn't. Like, it's partially mine. It's kind of mine. You know, maybe I should get, like, a characters created by credit or something, like they do at the beginning of every Halloween, but...
Well, yeah, the producer tells the story that when, you know, Lustig, you know, left the film production, he told the guy, the producer, to, you know, go F himself, and he stormed off. But a few years later, when they encountered each other at a party or something, a ceremony somewhere, he says, you know, Lustig comes up to me, it was all friendly and hi, and the producer's like, well, I thought you hated me. I thought you were mad at me. It's like, what? Oh, that was business.
Right.
That was business. That's in the past.
I imagine there's, I mean, I've never made a film, right? I only know sort of the backstory, and most of those backstories tend to be pretty bad ones because those are the ones that get, like, you don't really hear too much about movies that are made and everything goes well during the filming, right? It's usually the bad ones you hear about. And it's like, I could understand that again. Like, he was hurt, and rightfully so. So, but he also... Lustig is not stupid. He understands it's a business. I think he understood the math. I think if you could have talked to him even right after he quit with like a few beers in him, he probably even said the same thing. He's just like, look, I get it. It's a business, but it's also like, this is my baby. So no, I don't want my name attached to it. And I could entirely understand that. I'm still stunned that this ends up being as decent of a movie as it is. Probably even better than decent. Like, look, as a slasher, I guess it's, I don't know if you want to call these slashers. Maybe at this point it is, right? Because it's mostly, you know, about Matt Gordell and the kills. And it gives you all of that. Like, it, in terms of just purely, like, forgetting the maniac cop part and all that, like, just in terms of a horror movie in and of itself, it's a pretty good one, you know? It really is. Just in terms of, especially the third of a franchise, which is typically asking a lot, it's, again, pretty good. And the fact that it was still could do all that without their involvement at the end is impressive. I mean, maybe part of, I imagine he's ultimately disappointed because it wasn't his movie, but I wonder if Lustig or Cohen has seen it and what they actually think of it.
I doubt it because Lustig traditionally doesn't even discuss the film. He just completely disowns it and doesn't even want to acknowledge it.
I mean, that's fair.
He'll basically say, you know, like, it's not my film. I don't want to, you know, it's almost like, why would you ask me about, say, Die Hard? I didn't direct Die Hard. I
could sure
maybe give you my opinion on it, but you know,
sure. I was just curious. Yeah, I mean, and I get it. And a lot of creators don't watch their own stuff after it's done. It's like, you know, I spent 8 months or a year or whatever it was of my life on it. I don't need to know any more about it. Like, I did it. Now I move on.
I've heard it's like you know, once you know how the sausage is made, you can't really enjoy it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the movie opens up, and again, this is a tough one because when you think about it, Maniac Cop 2 wrapped up the story pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice, tight little bow. You know, it expanded on Maniac Cop, explained more of the situation, and Sean McKinney, played by Robert Davi, closed the case on Matt Cordell, cleared his name, well, at least for everything he did prior to coming back as in an undead rampage. But...
Right, that was just like, oh, look, we get it, our bad, so, our bad. And
Cordell basically self-destructs and is buried at the end of the movie with, you know, his full, you know, police honors. So Maniac Cop 3 opens up with a recap of that. Basically, there's a title card explaining that situation, and then we get some flashbacks of, you know, Maniac Cop 2.
And we get our subtitle, Badge of Silence, which obviously means... Matt, what does that mean?
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. There'll be a little bit of that in this movie. A lot of, like, I don't know.
Badge of Silence. I mean, neither of the two previous movies had a subtitle.
Right.
But they did have the tagline, you have the right to remain silent forever. I don't know if they're trying to play on that.
I feel like...
One of the taglines for the movie is... The wrong arm of the law.
That could have worked.
That would have been a better subtitle than The Badge of Silence, which just is like, all right, it's cool. It certainly sounds cool.
Right.
Maniac Cop 3, The Badge of Silence. But don't make no sense.
Right. I think, if anything, that subtitle makes more sense for the second movie. Right? Given the fact that it was as much a police conspiracy, hence A Badge of Silence, than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you could kind of go into the whole, you know, Code of Silence, which is one of Chuck Norris's best movies. But still, it don't make no sense.
No, it really doesn't.
All right, moving on.
Yeah.
We see Matt Cordell rising from the grave once again, and it's kind of like, huh, why? Well, what's this about?
Damn good question, Matt. And Matt.
We soon find out that there is a voodoo priest who has brought him back from the grave. He comes, you know, okay. We see Matt Cordell stalking the streets, moving through Manhattan. He comes to this old, you know, closed down church, and the voodoo priest is there. It's indicated that it's somewhere up in Harlem, but I don't think they ever quite state it. I mean, that was definitely part of the original script, that it was taking place in Harlem.
Right.
But they don't really get into that much here. And the priest is basically saying it's been a long time since a cop walked these streets. You know, there's been violence here, and we need a dark justice in these streets. So he's kind of implying, like, okay, he's risen Matt Cordell from the grave as a lethal protector for his neighborhood that doesn't see any actual policing.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. Let's go.
That is a fantastic idea.
Yeah, I love it.
Now, don't bring it up again because the movie does it.
Oh.
It's pretty much dropped.
Perhaps the biggest of its flaws is ultimately completely glossing over why Matt Cordell is even back. That might be the biggest flaw to start with. It was just actually, like, all right, cool idea, but that just kind of happened, I guess.
The reason he will now go on most of his murderous rampage is another reason he may have wanted to rise from the grave. And that is a new character we are introduced to, along with the return of Robert Davi as Sean McKinney, is Kate Sullivan. Officer Kate Sullivan. She's new to the force. She's already made a name for herself on the force by having, you know, accusations of excessive force used against her. We know she likes to use hollow points in her gun, which is illegal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she almost wears as a badge of honor that the other cops call her Maniac Kate. And, you know, this is all introduced to us as Sean McKinney and Kate are in the shooting range, you know, practicing their shooting. And yeah. It's also, and what's nice is they don't try to introduce her as a romantic partner to Sean McKinney. They state outright that Sean McKinney sees her as a kid sister. He's almost her older brother and her protector, which is his most important role in this film going on. Is that he wants to not only protect her, but her honor.
I just love, and it's such a movie thing, especially like, you know, a badass quasi action hero thing. When you know, they're in the shooting range, which is, you know, indoors, mind you, and they're shooting, you know, full caliber rounds into the paper targets and stuff. And she turns to him. She's like, oh, you're not wearing, you know, hearing protection. And he's like, I like the sound of gunfire. It's like, I get it, but that's not how, like, deafening works. You know, it's not quite as egregious as pain don't hurt, but I just chuckled. It's just like, okay, man.
No.
You'll just never hear again.
No, but, you know, Sean starts trying to give her some brotherly advice. Like, so first of all, Maniac Kate, you shouldn't take as a compliment. Mm-hmm. And second of all, you know, remember, we are police officers, and you need to be watching yourself. You know, you can't be using excessive force. It's right. Just not how it is. And this is one of the movies that is much like Dirty Harry. You know, this is very much like, well, the police have to do what they have to do.
Right, like the streets are so bad that
the streets are so bad, you know, like in Assault on Precinct 13, it's true law enforcement is being driven to deplorable means. But again, giving Sean McKinney the Dirty Harry role as presented in Magnum Force, where like, yeah, the system isn't perfect, but it's the system we got, and it's the system we've sworn to uphold.
Right, like we still gotta do it. You don't have to, yeah, exactly. No one said it would be easy.
So we get to that, and then we cut to our two, I will say, main villains somewhat, and they are basically, the best I can refer to them as is sleaze journalists.
Right, yeah.
Now remember, this is 1990, the early 90s, and you'll probably remember all those, you know, exploitive news magazine shows like A Current Affair and, you know, almost Predator 2, you had the Morton Downey Jr. character who had that, you know, these shows that are all about the graphic violence and true crime and all the, you know, the abhorrent stuff going on. And that's how they get their rating.
Did you ever see the movie? It's an excellent movie with Jake Gyllenhaal, Nightcrawler.
Nightcrawler, yes.
They're basically that. They're basically Jake Gyllenhaal and Nightcrawler.
They're two freelance photojournalists. Then they're constantly scouring the airwaves, the police bands, to find the most abhorrent crimes so they can be first on the scene,
right,
and film it, and then sell it to the network.
Right, get the big news break ratings, you know, like 15 dead, more at 11 type of thing, yeah. Exactly like Nightcrawler, if you've seen it.
That's exactly what they're looking for. Yeah. Like, they'll hear, oh, they just found a dead guy, you know, drug overdose. And, you know, like, oh, no, the news don't care about that.
Yeah, the mattress fire. Like, the guy's going through, like, this whole list of things, and they're all like, eh. to the point where the one guy's, like, literally praying for something awful to happen.
Well, and the problem there is, what's so important about this is, let's face it, it is true.
It's true, yeah.
This is exactly like, how the news media worked, and especially those sleaze journalism things. But now the mainstream media has become just as bad. They make the point that, oh, it's, you know, it's a black guy that died. Well, nobody cares. If it was a white guy, maybe we'd go. Or, you know, a white woman. That's what sells. That's what gets the ratings.
Yeah, the bulkheads in my apartment are creaking again. But yeah, like I mean, to me, it's less about what they hope to do and more about their enthusiasm for it.
Right.
You know, because it's like, I get where they're coming from. It's like, yeah, I understand. Yeah, I understand what you're trying to do. And I understand the stakes involved in doing it. And even like the little bit of like glee in knowing that you're going to get a big story. But again, think about this for a minute. You know, like you're so chipper about it. Like, ugh.
Well, fortunately for them, they get on the noseband that there's a violent holdup at a pharmacy. So we cut to Kate and her partner reporting to the crime scene, and her partner gets out of the car and is immediately shotgunned by the
Jackie Earle Haley, who I did not recognize,
playing a drugged out sociopath who just shotguns him like, and then he goes flying into the
yeah, it's a movie shotgun
windshield.
Yeah.
Kate immediately takes out an illegal weapon.
She's got a machine gun. It's a machine gun.
And storms the building, exchanging fire with Jackie Earle Haley. She finds another cop in there wounded, another cop in there dead. And Jackie Earle Haley is playing the late 80s style, the exact type of criminal you would see in
the beginning of Cobra.
Cobra.
Yeah.
You know, that type of, you know, he's mocking the cops that are, like, shot and suffering. Like, oh, does it hurt? So he's exchanging gunfire with Kate. And as Kate's firing on him, he dives into the pharmacy booth, which has bulletproof glass. So Kate, realizing she can't get in there the way she is, she starts to leave and she runs into the two journalists and, you know, shoves them out of the way, angry of them. You know, these idiots are right in the line of fire.
Right.
You know, taking pleasure in filming this carnage. And
Kate, and ultimately she's supposed to protect them too somehow. So, yeah.
Yeah. Kate makes her way onto the roof while the two guys are filming Jackie Earle Haley inside the pharmacy, taking every drug he can find.
Yeah.
At one point, he's so stoned, he sees the guys filming him and is like, oh, I'm on TV. Hi, Mom. At this point, Kate has made herself onto the roof and found a hatch that opens into the pharmacy, drops through, and shoots Jackie Earle Haley 3 times. Doesn't kill him. And while she was in there was this girl working at the pharmacy, who was trapped in there with Jackie Earle Haley, who's all up. She's like, don't worry, it's okay. We got him. She mistakenly turns her back and realizes, wait a minute. the pharmacy's locked. How did he get in here? And she realized the girl buzzed Jackie Earle Haley in just a second too late, because as she turns, the pharmacy girl picks up Jackie Earle Haley's gun and shoots her. But Kate is able to get a shot off before she goes down and shoots the pharmacist right through the brain. All three are down. The guys, the journalists, have all this on tape. And as bad as the situation already is, they decide to exploit Kate's reputation as Maniac Kate, and they edit the footage to make it look like Kate just opened fire and shot down the pharmacist in the crossfire, being completely indifferent to her being a hostage. They make it seem like she killed the hostage in right. the gunfight, and not what actually happened was the hostage was in on it and the hostage shot her.
Right. And that brings us around to the other subtext of the movie for pretty much all three, which is the police brutality sort of question.
Yes.
And that layers in and out of all of these movies.
But and it's about how bad cops hurt everybody.
Right.
It hurts the police force because, again, it's like, as we saw, especially in the first movie, nobody trusts the police,
right.
you know, because of all this excessive force. And it breeds fear and discontent and ill will.
Right. It helps no one, yeah.
And, you know, again, I will always say it. If you're not a good cop if you're covering for a bad cop.
Right.
I get the whole you need to count on each other, but stop protecting bad cops.
Right.
It makes it just, I don't know. So now Kate's in a coma from her injuries. So she's being rushed to the hospital. Sean McKinney's goes to be checking on her. And, you know, that's when Kate's mom shows up. And we establish that obviously McKinney's a close friend of the family. And the mother's like, you've always been her protector. But if God calls to her, make sure they let her go to him. You know, obviously signing a DNR for her daughter.
Right. That was that's how I understood it. Yeah.
Jackie Earle Haley has survived his bullet wounds and, you know, obviously is somewhat conscious, but he's already talking to a lawyer about suing the police department and, you know, Kate's reputation, which was already damaged, is now being dragged through the mud. And Sean doesn't believe for a second that what the news is showing actually happened. And he's going to do what he can to clear her name. And while all this, we're introduced to some of the hospital staff.
Yeah.
There is a Dr. Fowler, attractive blonde nurse who will become the romantic interest to Robert Davi. She's not involved in Kate's treatment, but because of the closeness to her, she kind of gets peripherally involved.
Right.
We meet Kate's doctor, who is an outright, you know, obviously brilliant surgeon, but is a complete and total ass.
Literally written to be murdered by Matt Cordell.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there are doctors exactly like him.
Sure, sure.
You know, people who, when you're going in for surgery, you want operating on you, but have absolutely zero bedside manner.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to sit at a table with them for more than 5 seconds
right.
because you'd be punching them in the face.
Right.
So a lot of the political...
The same kind of heartless, as you pointed out, the same kind of heartless detachment that you might want when they're operating on you, but not as your bedside advocate.
Or talking to your family.
Or even just, yeah, right, even just talking because to you generically.
Because when Sean McKinnon goes in to ask yeah. about her, and she's like, well, he's like, what's her religion? Catholic. We'll call a priest. You know, like,
right.
what's the prognosis? Stick her in a rock garden.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's a bit much, bro. That's a bit much.
And yet seems to be completely confused when people dislike him.
Right.
So Sean has, you know, not only is only hoping that she, Kate will
recover. Oh, and he's a sleaze, too, on top of it, because it's the 90s, of course.
Not only hoping Kate will recover, but he's also having to fight to clear her name, because the department just, the department is actually at this point, the department of the city is actually hoping she'll just die.
Right.
Because then they won't have to deal with it. And then they can just pay off this criminal whatever he wants to keep him quiet too. So we meet, well, there's an interesting, again, another little interesting scene where we see Sean talking to somebody at the police department, a file clerk or somebody, who is discussing Kate's case as it is being treated by the higher ups. And he's even saying, like, look, this guy, you know, Kate, the forensic doesn't tell us whether what we saw on that tape is 100% right or not. Because Sean is saying she wouldn't have shot this innocent pharmacist. If this pharmacist right. got a bullet in her, there's a reason for it. And he's like, well, all I can tell you is that, you know, at this point, she had illegal ammunition in her. She was using a gun that was not police issue.
Yeah, forget the five. Yeah.
In her police issue gun, she was using hollow points. We can't use those.
Right.
You know it. I knew it. Kate knew it. And unfortunately, the scumbag she shot knows it, because he's suing the city for everyone we take out of him, which at this point is three.
Right.
The great thing about this scene is the file clerk, or whoever this character is being played by Grand L. Bush.
Yep.
And you've seen him in things before. He was one of the Sorrells in Streets of Fire. But what's key here is, if you remember Die Hard, and let's face it,
yep.
anybody listening to this podcast remembers Die Hard.
Hell, it's Christmas. You're probably watching it.
You will remember that Robert Davi played FBI agent Johnson in Die Hard, and he was on scene with another FBI agent Johnson, who was played by Grand L. Bush.
Yep.
So you got a little Die Hard reunion right here. Actually, another actor from Die Hard who played the police chief, Paul Gleason, is also in this movie, playing the city attorney.
Oh, yep.
So, yeah, you get to see him. He's coming in. He's basically representing the city in the lawsuit that's being filed against them by Jackie Earle Haley. Now, we have Matt Cordell seems to kind of have a psychic link. And I should point out that the character of Kate Sullivan was originally scripted to be the character played by Laureen Landon in the first two movies.
Oh, literally the same name, everything. They were supposed to reprise the character, different actor. So, okay.
Yes, it was supposed to be, instead of her being killed by Matt Cordell in Maniac Cop 2, she was only put in a coma, and she would be the one lying in the hospital in a coma for most of this movie, which, as
would have made more sense. Into,
could easily have been called Maniac Cop 3, Bride of Maniac Cop.
Yeah.
Because Maniac Cop now feels a kinship with Kate Sullivan, because not only was she a good, dedicated cop who may have used some excessive force, but now she is being
betrayed,
hung out to dry, and falsely accused of things she did not do, just as Matt Cordell did.
Right, not only that, but then she's also being more or less betrayed by the department. Yeah,
exactly. Although at least this time the department isn't behind the betrayal.
Right, they're not instigating, you know, it. They're just taking advantage of the easy way out, or what they feel is the easier way out.
Just looking for the easiest way out. So Matt comes in and starts his killing. You know, he starts killing first her doctor, because he's obviously indifferent. There's a scene. It's a spectacular. It's so well done. This is, you know, again, one of the, like, this may be the weakest movie, but there are scenes in this movie worth seeing.
Yep.
There's a sequence where Robert Davi is sitting at Kate's bedside, and we get this, I guess it's a dream or a coma dream sequence of Kate is dreaming about herself in a wedding gown. And she's in this church, and as she's going down the aisle, she sees, like, it's very eerie.
Yeah.
All these obviously dead cops. who have been probably been killed in the line of duty or whatever. But as she's going down the aisle, and it's all blue and misty and moody, and these cops are just sitting there staring at her with their cold, dead eyes as she moves up the aisle to find out she's about to be the bride of Maniac Cop. And she briefly comes out of her coma and starts squeezing Robert Davi's hand. And he's like, Kate, Kate. And to add to that creepiness, all of a sudden, Matt Cordell comes out of the shadow behind Robert Davi just to kind of lean in to see what is going on. Mm-hmm. Davi goes running out of the room calling for a nurse or a doctor. And he gets Dr. Fowler, who, again, he's been talking to. And Dr. Fowler, I guess we should point out, Dr. Fowler is Jackie Earle Haley's doctor.
Right.
You know, she works in the criminal wing where Jackie Earle Haley is locked up and being treated. She comes to check on Kate, and, like, she goes, you know, well, I'm not seeing anything, but, you know, it could happen. I will go talk to her doctor and tell him to, you know, something he needs to look into. And she does. And of course, the doctor's like, no, it's, you know, it happens. It's a twitch of the deaf nerve. This woman is brain dead. She's not coming back.
Right. She says something like, stick a 9-volt to a dead frog and you'll get something.
You'll get the same result.
Yeah. Which, well, again, cool. Nice guy. Yeah. Just a nice guy.
He's also just sealed his fate because Matt Cordell has decided he doesn't like this guy. And he ends up, you know, killing him with a pair of shock paddles. Murders escalate, you know, and of course, when Dr. Fowler actually said, like, you know, after, you know, after the doctor was killed, I saw this, you know, is there a big, huge, silent, uniformed police officer stationed to Kate's room? Because I saw him leave her room and go down into the tunnels under the hospital. Well, McKinney immediately like, that sounds familiar. I'm going to have to look into that. Because the next murder victim we see is played by Robert Forster, who is my Whip Pistol Award winner.
Yeah, it's a short scene, but it's Robert Forster. He's great.
He's obviously the head of medicine at this hospital. And we're introduced to him as he's walking through the emergency room, you know, just kind of checking on things and like, oh, well, just, you know, do like, you know, he's business minded. I almost wonder if his character was inspired by the producers of the film, because he's obviously all he cares about is the budget. Like, the doctor's working on this guy with an injured leg and he's like, oh, all right, just do this and, you know, remove the leg. And she goes, but we haven't lost the leg yet. He's like, as far as I'm concerned, he's already lost the leg. And this is where Paul Gleason is introduced, because Paul Gleason wants, since he's the head of medicine and Kate's doctor is dead, he's like, I just need you to sign this form declaring that Kate Sullivan is dead and we can take her off life support so we don't have to pay for that anymore. And Robert Forster is like, yeah, more than happy to, because we could use the bed and, you know, we don't need to be wasting our time on, you know, this, you know, dead officer who's just, you know, taking up a bed and using up electricity with the life support system. Well, that seals his fate, and he gets a rather spectacular death when, again, we're not sure about how the math works.
But again, it's a horror movie, so yeah, it helps to not think too much.
Matt Cordell straps him down in the x-ray department, turns the x-rays on full, and just keeps snapping pictures, you know, cooking Robert Forster to death with the x-rays. So McKinney is now convinced that Maniac Cop Matt Cordell is back from the grave once again. He's afraid of, you know, what this means for Kate, as well as what it could mean for the department, because the department's already got enough trouble. There was a sequence earlier in the film where Matt Cordell is in the shadows outside the hospital, and this guy just kind of wanders up to him and starts antagonizing him, like, oh, you cops, you think you own the city, you know, you think you can, that badge gives you the right to do whatever. Well, you know what? She deserved what she got up there. Cordell just grabs the guy, throws him up in the air, and uses him as a clay pigeon because he pulls his gun and shoots the guy five times before he hits the ground.
I mean, the movie, I mean, again, it does not disappoint with the horror elements, at least.
No. Unfortunately, it does feel a little disjointed. You can tell where it's been.
You can tell it's been cut together and tried to make the best of. Yeah. Like, that's probably, I mean, the biggest flaw is the obvious. Like, you could tell it was made. Like, once you read the story, it's like, oh, yeah, I can see that. But yet, somehow, it still is entertaining.
Yeah. Now we get back to our two sleaze journalists who are, again, patrolling the city looking for something horrible to film. And they find out, ooh, a 10-year-old girl has been shot and killed. Ooh, that's going to be great. Let's go check that out. They pull up to the scene. One of them heads ahead, runs ahead to, you know, get an idea of the situation. And the other one is grabbing the camera equipment. And again, just it's a bit of clunky dialogue, but it's obviously, you know, set up for a reason, where one of them had said, geez, what do you think would happen if anybody saw the unedited footage we got of Kate Sullivan? You know, obviously implying, you know, like we still have, for some reason, the unedited. And maybe they kept it for a bargaining chip in the future sometime. How, like, you know what? We got the evidence that'll clear you this cop's name if you let us do whatever.
Right.
So one of them goes running off. The other one grabs the camera. He sees this young kid sitting in the thing all sad. He's like, hey, kid, did you see what happened? Kid kind of nods, Oh, what happened? Girl got shot with the shotgun. Ooh, was it bad? Was it bloody? Did you know her? Yeah, she was my sister. And for a minute, you almost see what you think might be a bit of humanity on the guy's face. But instead, he goes, well, gee, that sucks, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Proceeds to the scene, and then he can't find his partner. He sees the ambulance there. He can't see anybody around, but he's looking around, can't find his partner. He opens up the ambulance, and there are the two dead EMTs and his dead partner all cut up, and he is killed by Matt Cordell. And again, it shows, you know, these two EMTs were just doing their job. So Matt Cordell does not care about collateral damage as the undead, rage-filled maniac cop. He steals the unedited footage and goes to Sean McKinney's car, pulls the door off of it, and leaves the tape on Sean McKinney's seat, which cuts to where he finds the tape, finds that this evidence will clear Kate, and he brings it to the proper authority so that Kate's name will be cleared, which it is. Maniac cop returns to the hospital. Well, we should say Sean and Dr. Fowler are kind of celebrating. You know, Sean is happy that, you know, even if it doesn't look like Kate will ever recover, he is at least clear. Her name is cleared. She is not going to be labeled as the cop that killed some innocent bystander. And, you know, so he's kind of in the doctor's lounge, you know, kind of romantic situation when maniac cop arrives, but he goes into the secure ward. He uncuffs Jackie Earl Haley, leaves him a gun, and walks out. This causes, of course, you know, Jackie O'Haley takes advantage to, like, oh, I got a gun. Maniac cop often left them the keys to the handcuffs. He unlocks two other criminals that are there with them, and they make their escape by killing three people. There's a shootout, and they're going to make their escape. One of the people killed in the shootout is shouldn't say it's amusing. You know, it's the old joke of about, you know, what do you say when, you know, 10 lawyers go over a cliff?
Right.
He shoots his own lawyer during the escape. And as he's, you know, they're going out, he's like, oh, man, I shot my own lawyer. One of the other criminals is like, so what? You'll get another one there.
They're free. Yeah. It's a good quip. It was a good quip and a pretty intense scene.
Sean was obviously there at the hospital, and he's there to get. He gets in a shootout. This is his big action sequence. You know, he gets in a shootout with the three criminals, kills all three of them. It's a well done sequence, and returns to, you know, he was injured, so you see, you know, Dr. Fowler like treating his injury, you know, like, you know, nothing major, but again, things are getting romantic, and you're kind of like, you know, there's six corpses up in the thing right now.
But that's, I mean, yeah, that's, again, that's another thing with movies, especially horror movies, where just like this, like love scenes. It's like, guys, eyes on the prize here.
But obviously the police were there investigating. And since Sean was involved, he shouldn't be on the scene.
Right.
Because a little bit later when the reason the maniac cop did this was he needed a diversion for him to get Kate out of the hospital.
Right.
Because while Sean was shooting it out with the criminals on the floor or in another wing, maniac cop has picked up Kate and has left the hospital with her. So that's when, you know, when Sean's being treated by Dr. Fowler, his partner comes in and says, Sean, Kate's gone. He's like, well, what do you mean she's gone? I mean, she's gone. Somebody took her off life support and carried her out of here. She's gone. And he turns to Dr. Fowler, like, how long can she live without life support? She's like, a minute and a half at best. So they go racing off, and they follow the trail that kind of leads down into the tunnels. And Sean, he's like, where do these tunnels go? And he goes, they used to go to some of the other buildings that are all closed down. I think this one goes to the old chapel. They arrive at the chapel and they find all these candles lit, and the voodoo priest that had risen Matt from the grave is now doing the same ceremony to bring Kate back from the grave, because maniac cop wants his maniac bride.
Right. Hence Bride of Maniac Cop, which would have been a fun title for it.
Yeah. And well, and especially since this climax, what's about to happen, really is something out of an old Universal Studios film.
Oh, yeah.
So Sean and Dr. Fowler arrive in the castle, the chapel.
Chapel, yeah.
As the ceremony is coming, he puts his gun on the voodoo priest, like, no, you let her go. You know, she's done. You do not bring her from the grave. You hear a shotgun being pumped, and you turn, and there's Matt Cordell with the shotgun, pointing at Sean McKinney, yelling to the priest, finish it.
Right.
And Sean starts pleading with Cordell. He's like, I can't imagine what you're going through. Do not do this to her. Don't put her through the same living hell you are living in right now, Matt. The priest concludes the ceremony, and back to when he first was talking with Matt Cordell and says, look, I wouldn't have been able to raise you from the grave if there wasn't something still inside of you
that wanted letting back.
You come back. Yeah. Yes.
He actually mentions that earlier in the movie when he sees Cordell earlier.
He says to, like, she's not coming back. She is at peace. I can't raise her from the grave.
Right.
Ironically, the maniac cop, by clearing Kate, has allowed her to rest at peace. And
essentially the plot of the second movie, yeah.
Yeah. So, being the maniac cop and being who we've seen the rage-fueled cop over the last, you know, first part of this movie and the previous two movies, puts down his gun and just passes away. No.
Yeah.
He kills the priest, knocks over a candle, starts this huge fire, picks up the body of Kate, engulfed in flames, and starts chasing after Sean McKinney and Dr. Fowler as they're trying to escape. And again, we get another full body burn.
Yeah.
Which are just, I will always say, are so incredibly dangerous to do. They're spectacular to watch, but insanely dangerous.
Yeah, well, because, like, you can't breathe. I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but, I mean, back then it was literally like you wear a bunch of stuff that hopefully protects you from the fire, and then we set you on fire, which, okay, fine. Maybe you're not being burned, but you can't breathe lest you breathe in flame.
You can't breathe. You can't see.
Yeah, you can't see.
But we get these fantastic shots of him marching through the burning chapel.
Holding her, yeah.
Holding her body, which is engulfed in flames, while his body is engulfed in flames. And Sean McKinney and Dr. Fowler are panicking, trying to bust down the door to get the hell out of there before they get closer. It's amazing. It is, again, it is all worth watching this movie for.
Well, that's the thing. Exactly. Like, if nothing else, you know, if the disappointment, if you're watching this and you're disappointed, I mean, hopefully you're still at least entertained because what you're getting is still great. And, you know, they still keep you with a big payoff that the other two movies had given you, you know, like that all, at least all of those elements are still held together.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Fowler is either overcome by the smoke or the stress of the situation or both. She passes out, so McKinney is carrying her. He's able to kick down the door and get out of the church just in time to see it just engulfed in flames and collapse behind him. And there's, you know, the police are all there like, oh, Sean, it's you. Like, what happened? So now we kind of get our, you know, denouncement. Dr. Fowler's being treated in the ambulance. They're giving her oxygen. She's going to be okay. Sean McKinney's there with her. The maniac cap has finally been destroyed in the fire behind them because we see him almost, it almost kind of looks like he explodes, but, it's, you know, it's all this flame and the building collapsing down in on her. And the ambulance driver is saying, all right, we're ready to go. Do you want us to take her to Queen of Mercy, which is the hospital all this has been taking place right at? And McKinney's like, no, take us to another location.
The other one, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, they close it up and we're going to get our, you know, little romantic denouncement as they drive off in the ambulance. You know, Sean's actually kind of holding up the, you know, the oxygen mask to her and she's awake and, you know, they're making their little goo-goo eyes at each other and everything's going to be happy and the end. No. Now the movie dials it up to 11. Because out of nowhere, a police car is chasing after them, and at the wheel, still fully engulfed in flames, is maniac cop Matt Cornell chasing after them.
It's fantastic.
How they pulled this off, I'm sure most of it is that the car is being towed, but we get one of the most insane car chases I have ever seen as this police car driving through high traffic, chasing this ambulance.
No door.
With a guy who had a full body
burn. Yeah, no door so you can see the full body burn. And the car is on fire.
And the car is on fire. And he's reaching out and trying to grab at them. And they're screaming. And the ambulance driver's like, hey, what's going on? What's the big deal? And he looks. And there is Matt Cordell reaching in towards him. And the ambulance driver makes the reasonable decision to exit the ambulance
yep.
as it is going at full speed in traffic rather than deal with this flaming revenant trying to come at him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to blame them for that.
So now Matt Cordell has to climb up into the front of the ambulance, take control driving while they're being chased. And Matt keeps kind of smashing into them, reaching in to grab them.
He's Dr. not a very Fowler, good driver.
I think he's a spectacular driver being able to control this high-speed police car while fully engulfed in flames, one-handed while leaning halfway out trying to grab people. I think that's pretty amazing driving.
I guess when you put it that way.
At one point, Dr. Fowler yells out, I hate this! Which is a fair assessment.
Yeah, that actually, that got a laugh out of me, actually. I laughed out loud when she said that.
Driving crazy, you know, all these other cars
knocking over mailboxes.
All these cars trying to get out of the way. I wonder what they're thinking.
Oh God!
Because first
you're just
of all,
in traffic, like in New York, going to like you know the deli or whatever, and yeah, you just see this like race by you.
Well, because at first you're just probably seeing like, well, there's an ambulance, a police car behind me. I should probably pull
sure,
over.
Yeah.
And then it's like, was there flames involved in that situation? Were they having a fight, the cops and the ambulance? I don't even know. I'm not getting involved.
And if those two journalists weren't such jerks, that here's their story.
Yeah, you know? This would have been a great story.
They just waited a little bit.
Oh, actually, but you know what? If they hadn't been jerks, it wouldn't have resulted in this.
True. Yeah.
So Sean McKinney, having seen Jaws, grabs the, you know, he has Dr. Fowler take control of the ambulance. He climbs into the back, grabs the oxygen tank they were using to treat her with, and throws that into the back of the police car, which is in flames.
Right.
Not only they're like trying to drive away, but this is when Matt Cordell, who has super strength, finally latches on and he's holding on to the ambulance. And now they're like, oh God, if the police car blows up, we're going to blow up. McKinney takes control again of the ambulance, and he's able to, again, he must be a great driver because he stares towards this train station, train yard, and he's able to get the railroad sign to cut right in between them, severing Matt's arm so that he can get away. But that causes the ambulance to flip over onto its side and crash. And Matt Cordell goes racing by, but he turns, spins the car to a 180, and is about to charge into their, you know, overturned vehicle, killing them all, when the oxygen tank finally ignites and blows him to pieces. And we get one final moment of badassery from Sean McKinney as he and Dr. Fowler escape the ambulance. Sean picks up, puts a cigarette in his lips, bends over off screen, and you see he's picked up Matt's still burning arm and uses it to light his cigarette, which he then tosses the flaming arm into the burning wreckage. And this pretty much wraps up. We get one final scene as Matt's and Kate's bodies are brought into the morgue and put side by side. And they are burned down to pretty much nothing but skeletons at this point. But the final scene shows Matt's hand reaching out from under his sheet and just kind of grabbing Kate's hand and holding it.
And then that's this. That's it. That's a wrap on Maniac Cop. Like, we don't get
that's
anything
else. That's the wrap on. That's it. That's it. For
no
30
reboots,
years,
no part fours, nothing.
And there's often talk about a reboot, and I am completely up for being seeing a reboot.
Yeah.
I do not want to see a Maniac Cop 4.
No. No, I mean, what else can you tell at this point? That's, yeah.
Well, not only that, is like, yeah, it's just going to dilute the story.
Sure.
And neither Larry Cohen nor Robert Zadar are with us anymore.
Right.
And I don't, a reboot is fine with, you know, a new script writer, you know, working on the old material and a new guy in as Maniac.
Oh, Robert Davi's not with us anymore either.
Robert Davi passed away?
Didn't he? Maybe I'm wrong. Hold on. Keep going. For some reason I thought he did. Yeah.
I had not heard that.
Hope I'm wrong.
But,
why did I think?
I would be up for a reboot. I do not want to see a continuation.
Nope, I'm wrong. He's alive.
Okay. I do not want to see a continuation of the story without Robert Zadar or Larry Cohen involved.
No, especially, like, look, exactly. If they're just going to keep going along, if they're going to take right off from part three, absolutely. You know, that's why I'm with you. I'd rather see a reboot, though.
And not only that, like I said, the story was pretty well wrapped up with part two.
Sure.
Now it is wrapped up with a nice little bow. We do not need to see, I don't need to see it. Try to continue the story again and just end up diluting.
Well, because, you know, especially like this far away, like it'd be, if they were going to do a part four, the time to do it would have been like 2000, maybe 2002, the latest. Now we are so far away from the first three that, you know, a good 30% of the movie is just going to be reminding us of the first one, if not the first three.
Yeah,
you know, like how the later Halloweens became, where it's like, you know, 30% of the movie is just telling you what you already knew about Halloween so they could continue the story. And it's like, yeah, well, I know this is like the 12th movie. I know the story of Halloween by now.
And most of these franchises that do have good movies in the later sequels are usually due to them rebooting or going off in another direction.
Right. And that's what this movie would have. That's what Maniac Cop would have to be in order to do anything, especially this far out. Just make it a reboot. Like, I don't need you to continue the story when I know for certain most of it's just going to be an origin story that I damn well know. And then, like, okay, fine. Now you've made a fourth, which implies you're going to make a fifth and sixth. And it's like, look, how much can you stretch this out? Just start over and tell a new Maniac Cop story.
Yeah. Now, as we indicated earlier, this script was almost completely changed.
Right.
Originally, they were going to have a completely new hero character played by an African-American actor and was going to be more involved in the black magic.
Yeah, the original idea sounds great.
Yeah, this new officer would have had a family history of voodoo. Whereas in this movie, Sean McKinney briefly mentions he has a little bit of knowledge of voodoo because since his involvement in Maniac Cop and Maniac Cop 2, it's kind of become a hobby of his, which is a good explanation.
It's an entirely understandable thing, yeah. Like, once you've already established there's, like, resurrection and vengeful spirits, maybe you start looking into it.
Yes, so there would have been much more involved in the whole voodoo aspect of the Maniac Cop in Maniac Cop 3. As we mentioned, the character wouldn't have been Kate Sullivan. It would have been Laureen Landon's character from the first two. But when they were, because a lot of these lower budget independent movies make most of their money through pre-selling the film
right
into foreign markets and into home media. When they were told by their Japanese distributor or whatever that an African American lead would not sell in Japan, they decided, no, we're going to have to bring back we'll bring back Robert Davi and have him do it. And that's one of the key things that William Lustig and Larry Cohen wanted to fight against. But, you know, I think, you know, despite their insistence on that, they acknowledged them, even themselves, as like, well, if we can't sell this movie in Japan, we don't get a lot of our money back.
Right. Right. It kind of screws everyone. It's a really shitty situation to be in. It's just a really shitty situation to be in. Yeah.
Because as far as I know, the other guy had already been cast too. Like, imagine finding out you're the lead in the movie, you know, even if it's a small independent movie, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the big break for a lot of these guys, you know, especially in the third movie, because you know it's going to build an audience from the first two, you know, so whatever percentage of people are going to see it. And that is, there's, you know, you think anyway, there's a distributor ready for it. You know, it has a reputation in Japan. You're thinking, okay, great. Only to be told, like, yeah, no, we can't sell you.
And because it's, you know,
yeah,
because you're
black. Yeah, that's just, it sucks. It sucks. I mean, it's the way it was in 93, apparently, but that just sucks.
I'm sure it's still the way it is.
Yeah,
today.
Well, in some markets, it very likely is. I'll even hear to an extent, you know. But yeah, it sucks because we got robbed of what would definitely have been a better movie. Again, despite all of its flaws that we explained, this is still a hell of a fun movie, especially if you've watched the first two. It's definitely worth to see the third. Even if it pales in comparison to my favorite, which is probably the second one.
How they managed to piece this together into a decent movie still astounding.
It really is. That's why I was saying at the beginning, like, to me, it's a testament to Cohen and Lustig that they were able to do as much as they did to the point where it almost couldn't be screwed up by people were not really intent to screw it up, but, like, didn't really have as much of an interest in making the right film as opposed to one that would sell.
Yeah. And like I said, there is some padding with old footage, especially there's that egregious scene of Matt Cordell shooting two police officers as he ascends a staircase that is just directly lifted from Maniac Cop 2, and not as a flashback.
And also, it's not like it was years and years in between movies like you would suddenly forget that scene, you know?
No, I mean, and I think that's the biggest thing I would say about watching Maniac Cop 3. You can watch Maniac Cop 1 and 2 right after each other. I would not recommend watching Maniac Cop 3 immediately after Maniac Cop 2.
Agreed.
Because it's even going to, all the flaws are going to be even more obvious.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. It's not going to be, you won't be as forgiving as you might be if you see it like a while later.
Yeah. I would say wait at least a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or two before you put in Maniac Cop 3.
Yeah. You'll
enjoy it a lot more.
I can't really think of a good analogy, but I guess it would be like binging a show only to find out the last couple episodes weren't that good. And it's like, then you find out later, like, oh, actually these last couple of episodes were pretty good. It's just, you know, in light of everything I had just binged before that, you know, like in real time, I would have had a week or two later or maybe a month when it was on hiatus and then come back to it and been like happy for what I got. Whereas this just feels, yeah. Like that's yeah. The thing. I think you're right. Like if we had seen this, if we watched this like over the course of like one night or over the course of a weekend, I don't think I'd be trashing this movie. In fact, I'd probably have more or less the same opinion, but I think I might be even more critical of it.
Well, it's also why I wanted to wait a couple of months before we concluded the trilogy from, you know.
Yeah, I think that was a good call. I think that was a good call because the closer this is in relation to especially the second one where that one scene is directly used, it does fall that much flatter. But on its own, sometimes later when you want just a bit more, it's sort of like when you've had a really good meal and you know you want more because it was so really good, but you can't really fit it. But you're like, oh, I'm just going to do it anyway. Stupid. But yeah, you know, you're just going to do it anyway. So you have just like a bite more to cap it. That's kind of what this is. It's just like a bite more. And it fits well in doing that.
Or it's the leftovers the next day and it just doesn't taste as good reheated.
Yeah, there you go. It's like the leftover, right. It's the turkey dinner leftovers where it's like, hey, it's still a pretty good turkey sandwich. But it's not the same as the dinner.
I also want to point out, this is actually the one I've seen the most.
What's the first one you saw? Right?
What?
Is it the first one you saw? Or is this
no,
part two, the second one?
The second one is the first one.
Okay.
But for a while there in the late 90s, early 2000s, this seemed to be the only one available on DVD.
Really?
Or at least readily available. I could buy Maniac Cop 3, but I could not find Maniac Cop 1 or 2. At least not, you know, I think they were put out, but then they were like limited release and people were selling their copy secondhand for like $100. Maniac Cop 3 I had on DVD and I couldn't get any of the other ones. So this was my only way to get a fix of Maniac Cop if I wanted to watch it.
Interesting. Like I think I read that it premiered in the US on HBO. Like it didn't get distributed in the US, not to theaters anyway.
Another Thursday Night Prime. But yeah, even after seeing this one the most, I think it's still a worthwhile movie to watch. Especially, I said, one of the most spectacular chases and climaxes I've ever seen.
Well, look, I mean, even if the...
While most of the movie is mediocre, the end of this movie dials it to 11.
Even in light, like, even if we didn't get the first two, even if this was the only Maniac Cop movie, it's still pretty fun. It would still be one I would recommend to horror fans. I'd still be like, yeah, this is a good one. Check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a reason it has the bad reputation is like, no, it is not. It does not nearly reach the heights. Again, except for the climax.
Right.
It doesn't reach the heights of Maniac Cop 2. So it's definitely a disappointment. And again, I think like a lot of fans who will binge the trilogy altogether, when you watch it immediately after watching Maniac Cop 2, it really it suffers more than I think it should by comparison.
Right. Yeah. You need a little bit of time to let the first two marinate to the point where you're like, I want a bit more Maniac Cop, and then this will deliver that well enough. You know, it's one of those. Again, it's hard to make a good franchise. It really, especially a horror one, when you tend to keep killing off the antagonist at the end. Like you have to keep stretching disbelief further and further, or you know, I don't even know. Like I'm not a filmmaker. I just it's hard to do, and to get three is an achievement. Especially when the third one probably shouldn't have turned out as good as it was, given how much was working against it.
But yeah, again, the climax, the two climaxes really are spectacular. Well, and the coma dream wedding is intensely eerie and creepy and very effective.
That was really well done. The stuff with, like, what bugs me is the movie that we could have got, because the stuff with the voodoo priest guy was really good. Like, that guy was awesome. And those scenes were really creepy and were working really well. It's like, yeah, that would have been cool to have more than that.
And Sean McKinney's shootout with the escaping criminals is well done and exciting. And extremely bloody. Yeah. Like, some really bloody bullet hits there.
You can tell, yeah, you can easily see like the parts and scenes that would have worked even better if they allowed to have the full vision through it. You can definitely see that the movie was intended to be made with the same amount of care as the first two. Like they weren't mailing this in.
No, they really...
You could see
people had to work hard on this movie to make it even as good as it was.
Right. And you can see, like, that's the other thing I appreciate too, is like you can tell, you can tell where it was flawed. You know why it was flawed. We explained it and you can read it. But you can also see, like, in what was done, the amount of care that was put in it, which I obviously, again, it helps make the movie that much better. Because, like, if the rest of that stuff was thrown together, like, yeah, hell, we wouldn't be on this podcast. We wouldn't even be talking about it. But I think ultimately, like, enough talent and enough vision worked out, you know, won out in the end to still give you something. And I would say, like, again, I you know, usually I will compare horror movies to other movies, like, you know, to other horror movies to try to set that expectation. And I would still contend that, you know, as I said, even on its own, it's still a pretty good one. It's still an excellent example of a good, you know, fun horror slasher, you know, a movie in line with any of the rest on a given, you know, Friday night.
I would actually even say this is probably the most slasher oriented of the three movies.
Sure.
All right, so unless you got anything else to say about Maniac Cop 3 specifically, what do you got for recommendations?
I mean, for recommendations, again, I mean, to me, it's, while it's not strictly speaking a slasher, and while the Maniac Cop is not not the same icon as, say, you know, Freddy or Jason or Michael, I also say that, you know, maybe he should be. I mean, it probably, for lack of not having more movies, and also for lack of not strictly speaking being slasher films, especially the first one, I think if you're a fan, you know, of any of those and haven't checked out this franchise yet, do it. It's well worth it. Like, if you, you know, again, if you're a fan of the Halloweens and Friday the 13th of the world, or just horror in general, definitely seek these movies out. They're well worth their place.
Even gritty urban action.
Yes, especially when it comes to the first one. Yeah.
The first one, if you're a fan of, again, low budget, you know, action grindhouse style, you owe it to yourself to check out Maniac Cop.
Right, like,
they're all available. They're all out there on Blu-ray. You know, they're readily available. Synapse put out the first one, and Blue Underground put out the 2 and 3.
Right, like, even if you're not strictly speaking a fan of horror, but if you're a fan of kind of horror adjacent, like Cobra, say,
or
it could work,
or you're a budding filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody who wants,
you could learn some stuff.
Filmmaker,
you know,
should check out these low budget films to really see how they can do it.
Right, figure out where you can put your money and put your focus and make something work.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to go a bit more obvious with, you know, the hidden, you know, violent shootouts, you know, with impacts against, you know, Unstoppable. Because, again, this movie, the Maniac Cop movies borrow a lot from Terminator and The Hidden.
Yeah.
And, you know, even RoboCop a little bit.
Yeah.
Maniac Cop and RoboCop would make a cool double feature.
That would make a very good double feature. Because you get two different sides of a similar story, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Both are very good. Actually, those are two excellent comparisons.
But we're at the third movie in this trilogy, and we did the recommendations during 1 and 2. I would just say, yeah, check out the Maniac Cop series if you haven't. Do you have a Magnificent 7 Degrees?
I do. So Robert Forrester, as you mentioned, was in this, playing like the chief of medicine at the hospital, who was also in Breaking Bad. He was like the vacuum, like, repair store owner, who was like the conduit. Like, he was the guy who could get you out of town and, like, get you, you know, the new ID and all that stuff. He's the one who helped, what's his face there, Saul, presumably escape to his better life. So Breaking Bad also had Giancarlo Esposito, who we mentioned on this podcast is in Taps. Very, very young Giancarlo is great in Taps. Starring George C. Scott, who is in Exorcist 3, which we've mentioned on this podcast, with Ed Flanders, who is in Salem's Lot, which we've mentioned on this podcast, with David Soul, who is also in Magnum Force, with Clint Eastwood, who is in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, with Eli Wallach, who is in Magnificent Seven.
All right, well, I'm going to go with Jackie O'Haley. Jackie O'Haley was in Damnation Alley with Jan Michael Vincent. And Jan Michael Vincent was in The Mechanic with Charles Bronson.
There you go.
But it occurs to me, I think I did that same with when we did Damnation Alley.
Oh, you probably did.
So, all right, I'm going to go with Julius Harris, who played the voodoo priest. Julius Harris was in Live and Let Die with Roger Moore. Roger Moore was in Gold of the Seven Saints with Clint Walker. And Clint Walker was in The Dirty Dozen with Charles Bronson.
Gold of the Seven Saints. I've never heard of that. Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's a pretty neat Western.
That's a Western.
You know, they basically, Roger Moore and Clint Walker are two buddies who stumble upon a lost cache of gold. And, well, shenanigans ensue as they, you know, try to get the gold and, you know, outwit bandits and at times even outwit each other to make off with the gold.
Oh, okay. Like I didn't realize it'd be a Western. It sounded almost like an adventure serial, like the kind of thing Raiders of the Lost Ark was based on.
It is kind of like that.
Oh, is it yeah, really? Okay.
Yeah. It's a fun and entertaining movie.
All right.
Directed by Gordon Douglas, who
oh, really?
I appeared on the Fade Out podcast to discuss the career of Gordon Douglas a few months back. So if you didn't catch me there, check out the Fade Out podcast, Gordon Douglas episode, where I was the guest there to discuss the career of Gordon Douglas and his final film, Viva Knievel.
Viva Knievel, yes.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to be gone for a couple of weeks. This wraps up this wraps up season three. We'll be taking the holiday off because the next two weekends are Christmas and New Year's. And, you know, not that we need a vacation from the podcast, but things will just be a little too busy for us to, you know, set time across to, you know, watch movies and record. But we'll be back in 2024 for season four, and I've already got some new guests lined up. It should be an even bigger year for us. And I want to also dedicate this episode and this season to the recently departed Andre Brower.
Yeah.
He is one of my favorite actors. Todd and I just finished binging.
Yes.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine. The day he passed away.
We had just watched the last three episodes of that day.
And I had just discussed with Todd that in the upcoming season, when we do our Hall of Fame inductees, Andre Brower was on my list to be on there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Because we have long admired him as an actor. Back Homicide, which is my favorite cop show. He was fantastic.
He was captivating.
As Frank Pemberton.
Yeah.
And there's an episode called The Subway with him and Vincent D'Onofrio, where Vincent D'Onofrio is basically playing a murder victim who hasn't died yet.
Yeah, that one's still, man.
One of the greatest hours of television I have ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's Andre Brower up against Vincent D'Onofrio, two powerhouse performers.
Yeah.
I would watch shows because Andre Brower was in them. Like, I would 100%. Not have been interested in Men of a Certain Age if Andre Brower had not been in it. But I watched every episode because of him.
Right on.
So I want to desiccate this episode and this season to him. And I'm actually just kind of ashamed of myself for not even having had him in our previous three induction ceremonies.
Well, it's
rest in peace, Andre Brower.
I think part of that is one of those things where, like, you know, you don't think about it when they're currently working, because he might have been still doing Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which he was brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You don't know what you got until it's gone.
No, no. And I think it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, you know, they're still working. I'll get around to them. They're easy to remember. So you're trying to think of people you don't remember as easily. But yeah, like he's fantastic. I mean, he was absolutely captivating in Homicide. And then playing, you know, a distinctly different character with a brilliant comedic turn, excellent casting and excellent writing for him in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I mean, he was a joy to watch in both. Not to mention, yeah, you know, the other movies and shows that he was in, he was tremendous in all of them, and it'll be, yeah, it sucks to not, you know, you're not going to see him in anything again. I especially would have loved to see him do more comedy. That you know, yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad. Yes, rest in peace, Andre.
I will remind everybody that they could follow us on X, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Movie Matt Sirois, all one word: MovieMattSirois. You can look at all the different lists and movies I've had ranked and starred and reviewed on Letterboxd, including a list I have of movies that turn the dial to 11, where Maniac Cop is on that list, as is a movie we previously reviewed, Demons, which is just another must-see movie. And you know what? I'm going to add that to my recommendation of this episode.
Sure.
The movie Demons.
That's a fun one just to roll with. Like, you know, that movie's great.
We thank you, as always, for listening. We'll be back in just a couple of weeks. And hope to have you back when we come back.
Thank you, everyone. Happy holidays.
Stay gold, people.